Welcome to Professor Ernst and his wife, Judy, told you about them. And if you don't know Linda Lodic, she is the interim director, executive director of the Keenan Institute for the Arts.
So, good morning. Good morning.
Yeah. So, it's yours.
Well, thank you very much, David. It's really a pleasure to be here, especially, you know, coming from Chapel Hill to Winston-Salem, you know, we are part of the same university system, and I know about the School of the Arts because our daughter actually did a year here in the dance program a long time ago, so we used to make the drive over from Chapel Hill quite regularly. In any case, I think it's a great opportunity for us to connect between the sort of academic work we do at Chapel Hill and the performance and creative processes here. It's really been, I think, an excellent opportunity for us to work with David Nelson and Kimberly Samuel. And, of course, the Keenan Institute has been extremely supportive of this, so this is a great initiative. So when David invited me over, I think this is a good chance to connect my new book, which is called How to Read the Quran. And I'm happy to say that there is a major piece of artwork on the cover, which is by the very famous Egyptian artist Ahmed Mustafa, who lives in London, and who is probably the most famous living artist from the Middle East who deals with traditional techniques, which that is to say, he employs calligraphy, but he does it in a highly conceptual fashion. And this is a Quranic passage, the famous light verse of the Quran, which begins, God is the light of the heavens and the earth. And if you can see it from across the table, you can see how it sort of invites you to dive into the middle of the script and go beyond. Let me just say a couple of words about what I'm doing in this book. I was initially approached by a publisher who asked me to do a new translation of the Quran. I thought about that for a while. It's a huge piece of work. But I ultimately decided that what was really needed was something else because we had a lot of translations of the Quran. Some of them are not particularly readable. In fact, most of them are not terribly readable. And yet, what's really the big problem is there is an immense anxiety about the mere existence of the Quran. And we've seen that over and over again, and you can recall in the past few years a number of incidents about, most recently in Afghanistan, a bunch of army people burning copies of the Quran and, you know, huge repercussions. And so I'm not going to go into that at the moment, but there's also been a huge kind of theological barrier, particularly from Christians who have historically had a sort of hostile theological relation to the Quran, viewing it as not just competitive, but false and fraudulent. And so therefore, they didn't have to really read it at all. It just automatically assumed to be, you know, out of the picture. And it's also the case that after perhaps the first century or so of the Islamic era, during that early period, there was a great deal of interest among Muslims in looking at earlier writings, biblical materials, and also narrative legends, which they call the Isra'iliyat, which you can hear the word Israel in there. But later, as time went on and the sort of a distinctive Islamic religious identity developed, there was a suspicion, increasing suspicion about this material as being, you know, doubtful, and in fact became dogma among many Muslims that the Gospels and the Torah were corrupt and had been tampered with, and so therefore you don't have to read them. Now, one of the real challenges for the modern reader who picks up the Quran for the first time is that the Quran is presented in a way that's very different from the Bible or other early religious writings. For one thing, it is aimed at an audience that knew these early writings extremely well. Consequently, the Quran does not bother with replicating biblical material very often, it assumes that you know who Pharaoh is and Moses, and it just refers to it in passing in the earliest passages. It just says, as when Pharaoh and Moses confronted each other, blah, 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 and so forth. And it's rarely that you find a connected, extensive narrative in the Quran, the major exception being the story of Joseph in Surah 12, which is very deliberate in its narrative presentation. It begins with the phrase, "We shall tell you the most beautiful of stories." And it does so richly with details that are not found in the biblical version, and with a great deal of artistic symmetry. In modern discussions of the Quran, European scholarship, just to summarize quickly, has set up several things which I draw upon in my presentation, one of which is the chronology of the Quran, and I marked this up on the chalkboard, and you can see that this is something which was proposed initially by a German scholar about 150 years ago. And it sort of belongs to the whole development of historical and literary criticism of the Bible as a text, which was a big development in the 19th century, and which has been fiercely resisted by conservative religious groups ever since. In fact, if you look at the movements that we refer to as fundamentalist, as notably proposed in the publications known as the Fundamentals, which came out around, 1912 or something like that, the two big issues were Darwinian evolution and higher criticism of the Bible. Those were the two major things that were being pushed back against by conservative Christian scholars. But and you know, there is conservative Islamic scholarship too, which resists this kind of thing. But I would just like to point out that there's also some extremely powerful academic scholarship going on among Muslims, and I dedicated this book to an Egyptian scholar, the late Nasser Hamid Abu Zaid, who suffered a good deal of persecution in Egypt during his lifetime. He died in 2010. But his works are extremely widely read, not only in Arabic, but in Persian and Indonesian translations and so forth. And he was really into this literary kind of approach. The chronological aspect of the Quran is really important because if you look at the way that the book is laid out, if you open up, that's probably both volumes of Arbery in one, I suppose, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And so one of the things you notice if you look at the table of contents is you have 114 sections called surahs, books or chapters, but they're basically laid out in order of decreasing size. Number two is the longest, number three is the second longest, and so forth, and the ones at the end are very short. It's not absolute, but it's pretty clear that this is the trend. This is, by the way, an arrangement you find in the letters of St. Paul in the New Testament. And it's in the Mishnah, which is perhaps a less commonly known text, but there are other ancient writings that employed this form of organization. But for the new reader, the challenge is that the material at the beginning of the Quran was the last to be revealed, the last to be delivered to its audience. And so it's sort of like reading a mystery novel by starting at the end. You don't know who the characters are. You don't know what the debates are. It's very confusing. And sort of number two plunges you into a lot of debates about different groups that were in tension in Medina during the latter part of the Prophet Muhammad's lifetime. And so it's very confusing. And frankly, anyone who's able to read through the Quran from start to finish probably has only succeeded by a sheer sense of duty, because you would never really, I think, find it a normal kind of read that where one thing connects to the other. So what I recommend is to really start with the material that was delivered first, and so replicate the experience of its first audience. And so that means we have two different periods roughly corresponding to the career of the Prophet Muhammad, his initial time in Mecca, where he was preaching to a very resistant audience. And we can talk about that if you like. But that goes roughly from the year 610 to 622, when he was invited to travel to Medina and become the leader of that community. And things changed quite a bit. At that time, he also became attacked by the pagans of Mecca, who were fiercely opposed to him, and there were internal divisions in Medina. So he was a leader, he had a following, but there were oppositions and so forth. So the situation was rather different. That Medinan period goes up to his death in 632. The form of the Quran changes dramatically over this chronology of 22 to 23 years. The earliest Meccan surahs have lines that are extremely short with a remarkable number of powerful rhymes. They're very dense, poetic, prophetic. They're concentrating on the afterlife, on Judgment Day, on the sins of avarice and greed, and the need to protect the orphan and the poor and those less fortunate and so forth. As time goes on, they become more expansive in the length of the verse, fewer rhymes, until when we get to the longer Medinan surahs, instead of having a verse of six words in length, you have verses that are 250 words long paragraphs. They're very prosaic, and they end on just a very flat rhyme that's basically the plural noun or plural verb form. So the style changes dramatically. The themes change a lot, too. And there's a lot more to be said about that. But anyway, I've mentioned the two major approaches that I'm recommending, chronology, and second one is intertextuality. From a literary point of view, we can look at the connections between the Quran and earlier writings, and that's what we're going to do to a certain extent today, because there's four narratives in Surah 18, one of which is kind of a generic parable, which doesn't really go back to any other early literary source. But the other ones are all deeply referential and really go back to the ancient Near East. The Seven Sleepers is an early Christian legend, which is about martyrs during the persecution of Diocletian, which was around 230 of the Common Era. The story of Moses and Khidr embodies elements of the Gilgamesh epic and really draws upon some very ancient legends of the Near East, although it has some distinctive aspects of it. The story of Alexander, well, that's Alexander the Great, right? Who was drawn into vast literary and religious cycles of narrative because he was kind of, you know, such a transforming figure, like the medieval emperor Frederick II, who was known as the stupor of the world. You know, Alexander just was a game changer. And so one of the things I want to mention to you is how he was, he became the subject of prophetic legends in early Christianity and was turned into a religious prophet. And that narrative comes into the Quranic version in a very particular form. But the last thing I wanted to say about the overall structure before we take a look at the actual text is what's called ring composition or symmetrical structure. And for those of you who are into writing, I think this is kind of an interesting point because frequently you'll hear modern readers talk about texts like the Quran as being hopelessly disorganized, chaotic, confusing. You know, we just don't know what's going on there. And I think this represents a deep disjuncture between ways of reading, between the very linear forms of narrative and presentation that we are used to, and a symmetrical or circular composition form that was very common throughout the ancient world. By ring composition, I mean that the beginning and the end correspond to each other, and the center is arranged very structurally so that it leads you to often to a singular point. And that's not always the case. But we find this in, there's a woman named Mary Douglas. If you're interested to see a nice presentation of this, she has a book called Thinking in Circles. And she has done this demonstration with books of the Old Testament, particularly Leviticus and Numbers, which are maybe not everybody's favorite reading. But it turns out they have this very intricate structure that is designed to lead you to the central point. And also, we find that in Greek literature, in Homer's Iliad, a recent study called The Shield of Achilles has shown that the Iliad is an incredibly tightly organized circular structure. This is found in a lot of ancient Semitic languages, in Akkadian and other materials. It turns out there's some recent work on Arabic literature, the Arabic poem or the ode. From pre-Islamic times up to the 12th century, it turns out, is regularly based upon this kind of symmetrical structure. You'll see more of the implications when we go through Surah 18. It's a good example. I mean, it's not the most potent because it doesn't have a particular single verse. I mean, I haven't really identified that as such, but in some cases we do find that there's a central section that dominates the whole composition and gives you special insight. So those are the 3 points that I think are really worth doing in, to enable you to read this text. So why don't we start? And what I want to do is take apart this Surah 18, with you, and I want to ask you to read some sections out loud in one or another translation. And if you have a translation in front of you, we're going to have somebody read one translation, and if anybody sees some notably different versions, flag that so we can, you know, discuss that, because I think it's always interesting. Now, I'm going to point out, first of all, how the introductory and closing sections link up. This is the main principle of ring composition, okay? And I'm going to point out the similarities first, and then we're going to read through the two passages. So it starts off in verses 1 and 2. This may cause you to flip back and forth, okay, because I'm going to give you the links. It starts off with verses 1 and 2, asserting the revelation is a written scripture or book that is straight without any crookedness. And in verse 109, it closes with a dramatic description of revelation exhausting even a sea of ink, which is another image of the book. So that's an assertion of revelation. That's a very typical open and closing gambit. At the beginning and the end, it brings a warning to believers in verse 2 and verses 103 to 106. And then it promises eternal bliss in paradise to the faithful in verses 2 and 3, as well as in 107 and 108. Now, there's a very noteworthy debate section, which is a common feature of Quranic rhetoric. Yeah, I've got them sort of back-to-back there.
This is the entire length, right? Just from...
No, that's just the introduction and conclusion.
Yeah, the introduction and conclusion.
I put the introduction... I'm taking it apart in my book.
Oh, I see.
So we've got the introduction followed by the conclusion, so you can see them together without turning so many pages.
You haven't read the book?
She's not looking at you.
No, this is the only one that escaped my perusal before it went to the publisher.
Okay.
And I don't know if that was a mistake or not, because I haven't read it.
She was going to too many meetings. Okay, so we've had, as I said, we had, you know, warning to the unbelievers, eternal bliss, promise of the faithful. Then there's a debate section in verses 4 and 5, which rejects the Christian notion of incarnation. Even while it is in 110, it then affirms on the contrary that the Prophet Muhammad is only a mortal human who is inspired by God. You see the contrast there? I mean, that's a very firm rejection of the notion of incarnation, but it does so by contrast. Then the deceitful word of ancestral tradition in verse 5 is contrasted with 109, where we have the limitless words of God's revelation. That's another important debate with local tradition. There is a consolation in verse 6 to the messenger who is disregarded by his people, and this is balanced in 110 by the declaration that he is indeed inspired. Finally, the signs of God receive emphasis in the beauty of the earth that is a test for humanity in verse 8. And in 105, the signs of God are the object of the disbelief of the misguided. So I think I've lined up quite a series of balanced parallels, and it seems to me that this sort of sets up the whole subject here. And I think you could also say that there's an overall theme here that will be borne out in the stories about resurrection. Let's see. Well, maybe we should just read this, the introduction and conclusion. I've signaled to you the theme, so maybe we could have Chris, why don't you give us Arbery's for the first 8 verses?
Okay. Praise belongs to God, who has sent down upon his servant the book, and has not assigned unto it any crookedness, right, to warn of great violence from him, and to give good tidings unto the believers, who do righteous deeds, that there shall be a goodly wage therein to abide forever, and to warn those who say, God has taken to himself a son, they have no knowledge of it, they nor their fathers. A monstrous word it is, issuing out of their mouths, they say nothing but a lie. Yet perchance, if they believe not in this tiding, thou wilt consume thyself, following after them of grief. We have appointed all that is on the earth for an adornment for it, and that we may try which of them is fairest in works, and we shall surely make all that is on it barren dust.
Okay. Let me ask Judy to do the last closing line in 103 to 2010.
Me?
Yeah.
You're
at the table.
Closing. Okay. Say, shall we tell you whose actions are most useless? Those whose effort goes wrong in this life while they think they have done something beautiful? They are the ones who reject the signs of their Lord and the meeting with him, so their deeds go wrong. And we won't give them any weight on Resurrection Day. That will be their reward, hell, since they disbelieved and they treated our signs and our messengers with contempt. Those who have faith and do what is right have a lodging in gardens of paradise. They are there forever, having no desire to leave. Say, if the ocean was ink for the words of my Lord, the ocean would be used up long before my Lord's words, even if we brought another like it to use. Say, I am only a man like you to whom has been revealed that your God is one God, and he who hopes for the meeting with his Lord, let him do what is right and not give anyone a share of the worship of his Lord.
So that's the beginning and the ending. I mean, any comment about the difference in translations? I don't think I'm too far off from Marbury, but try to avoid the thous.
Yeah. And hell is often replaced with the word Gehenna. I'm guessing that's the correct term for it.
Yeah, right, which matches up with a Hebrew term. Yeah. That's a little more arcane. I was striving for
I
wanted something a little more user-friendly. Just a couple of other style notes before we get into the stories. Overall, I think what we could say about this surah, like many others, not all, in fact some of them have a double structure, this has a triple structure. Many have a triple structure, a tripartite structure. Introduction, conclusion, and then a main body, which really parallels the order of the monotheistic worship service, where the scripture holds the central part of the worship service, the reading of scripture. So what I think we see coming up is the treating of these stories as is very analogous to the scriptural portion of what would have been found in the Jewish or Christian or other monotheistic worship service. There's another parallel to this too, which is the ancient Arabic ode, which has a tripartite structure, although it's a secular form, but there's a reason for seeing this kind of thing there. One other point of style is you will notice the prominent dialogue feature of this particular text, where the word say is followed by words which are then to be, you know, a message to be delivered. But what's important, and this happens, I think, a total of, there are seven verses directed to you in the singular in the surah, and seven passages that contain the word say as a command. So they're very dialogical. And one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, if there is a verse in the Quran which contains the words, say, shall we tell you whose actions are most useless? The message that the receiver would have relayed would have been that whole phrase, including the word say. It wouldn't have just been the contents that follow the word say. So it means that the listener and then the reciter of this are internalizing that dialogue and reiterating it on every occasion. And that's a really important feature of this text. So why don't we just go to the stories. Has anybody run into the companions or the of the cave or the seven sleepers of Ephesus before? I mean, if you were a French Catholic, you would probably know this one pretty well. I mean, there is a shrine to the seven sleepers in France, and they were a very popular subject of Christian legend throughout the Near East. There are shrines to them throughout Asia as well in Muslim context. And Ephesus in Turkey is also, in local tradition, is believed to be a site where the Virgin Mary was buried. And this was recognized by the Catholic Church, even though, you know, there's competing evidence elsewhere. You know, there are people who go to that, Christians and Muslims. So this is a very interesting sort of phenomenon. It's kind of a Rip Van Winkle story. They go to sleep in this cave to escape this persecution. And in the Quranic version, they're accompanied by their dog. I've got a picture of the dog here. I mean, there are some people who say that this is a result of a mistranslation from the Syriac, but I refuse to believe that because I like this dog.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of pictures of it, but this is one from a world history that was written in...
What page?
124. Written in a history produced in the Mongol period. But there you see them kind of packed into the cave. And
it's Mongol, not Mongol.
They're wearing Mongol gear, as you can see. And there's a funny looking horse there. But so this is kind of an enigmatic story because they wake up after a long period of time, which turns out to be 309 years. And it's a different world, and they try to go into the village and spend their money, but it's from an ancient time, and, you know, this becomes a sign of the resurrection, basically. If God can do this, God can raise us all from the dead. So. What did you have any thoughts about this? I mean, aside from liking the dog. Possible material for a screenplay.
Well, of course. Right.
Well, how does it fit into the rest of the context of the story? I mean, why does it show up here?
Well, I think it's because of the resurrection.
So there's I mean, I haven't read it, so forgive me for that, but is there
okay.
A prelude to where you expect that the resurrection is going to be spoken about?
Well, it starts off by saying, now the Quran really sort of does a lot more sort of explanatory and moralizing comments than the Bible. The Bible just tells you the stuff, you know. But here the Quran goes, now have you realized that the young men of the cave and the epitaph were one of our astonishing signs?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like, people, pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have these young men's sheltering the cave. We, God speaking the plural, sealed up their ears in the cave for years of a certain number. We raised them up. Then we raised them up, you see. It's using the term to awaken and to resurrect as being, you know, more or less parallel. And you know, the highlighting of Resurrection Day in the beginning and the end of the surah. You know, for instance, Resurrection Day is mentioned explicitly in on verse 105 and so forth. That's the symbolic link of this, because this shows the miraculous power of God in the signs. When it says one of our signs, the signs of God are the signs that are in nature or in astonishing, you know, deeds like miracles, which demonstrate that God has the power to create the world and to bring you back from the dead. And if you're so stubborn and bullheaded that you can't listen to that, then this is what's going to happen to you. So it's a pretty strong message. And it emphasizes the narrative thing. In verse 13 says, we shall tell their story truly. So the element of narrative is really highlighted. And it's about, emphasis on monotheism is very high because they are fleeing from persecution by a polytheistic opponent. So there's no clearer example of somebody who's following the message. And it lingers in a kind of loving manner. At verse 18, it says, you would figure them awake though they're sleeping. We make them turn over to the right and to the left. And this is when the dog shows up. But it also portrays it as being awe-inspiring. If you had seen them, you would have been filled with fear. You would have turned and fled. So that is a kind of a dramatic highlight thrown in. And then they have this, there's a lot of funny stuff about numbers in here, because they don't know how long they've been there. And this is all about how only God knows the reckoning of the judgment day. And that's explicitly stated in verse 21. Thus we revealed them, so the people would know God's promise is true and there was no doubt about the hour. He's not telling you when it's coming, but this is an absolute sign that it is coming. So this is a case, I think, where there's an internal commentary in the story to tell you, this is what the story means. And so you might find that a little heavy-handed, but that's sort of the style of, you know, this kind of explicit revelation.
Is the assumption here that the readers would have known this story commonly? Or is this being introduced here and so the narrative is trying to acquaint them with it?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, it's so detailed that, you know, you could assume that this might be novel to some people. As we're going to see in a minute when we look at the Alexander one, it is compressed. We have a longer version of it in Syriac that can actually be dated very precisely, one of the few cases where we have a external documentation of something. I mean, it's actually really hard to give specific dates to most of the passages in the Quran. This chronology that has been proposed is based on internal style rather than external historical proof. But this one it's a nice story. It's got a lot of detail, so there'd be more reason to think that it was a fresh story for some people than in other cases where it's very elusive and elliptical. I'll just give you one example. In Numbers, I believe, when the Israelites are ordered by God to go to the Promised Land, they fail miserably, except for two people, Joshua and Caleb. The Quran does not mention those by name, but it just talks about the two.
Mm-hmm.
So you know who they are. I mean, it's that level of illusion. So this is a case where I think we have a pretty clear example. When it ends up, it has them in verse 31 in the Gardens of Eden, in a very typical kind of imagery, lying on divans beside the rivers. That's, you know, the sort of paradise resurrection imagery that very important in the Quran, but this is a clear example of a Christian legend that has become part of the repertoire here. And the commentaries are pretty clear about that. They identify that as a, you know, part of early Roman history. And there's also a tendency to look at these, you know, as being uncorrupted Christians, because, you know, the story has been introduced by a refutation of the doctrine of incarnation. So these are okay Christians in terms of the Quranic monotheism.
Would they have been familiar with the Jewish Psalms?
Absolutely. The intertextuality is quite remarkable. And we have, there are cases which, as you know, I mean, the New Testament has abundant references to the Psalms and other Hebrew biblical texts. The Quran frequently refers to both the Psalm and the same book of the New Testament that commented on the Psalm, but a different passage from, say, the book of Luke in this connection. So, I mean, it shows a literacy about how the New Testament uses the Old Testament.
I was just thinking about the way that awake is used for rising up after death in the,
yes,
in the Psalms. And if they had that idea, if they were that familiar, a story like this would connect not only to whatever tradition, but to their understanding of those texts.
I think those kind of strong metaphors are, you know, widely spread and so forth. I'm thinking of other ones like memory and forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be at a dissertation defense tomorrow that talks about the memory and forgetting among the monks of the Egyptian desert. And the reason why is because the person who wrote the dissertation took my Quran class because she wanted to look into the Quranic use of that very, you know, correctly, because those are, you know, fundamental terms for, you know, which things you can extrapolate. Remembering the favors of God and being grateful and so forth. The next section, I don't know if we need to spend too much time on it. It's got a parable of two gardens and a parable of life in this world. These are kind of generic. In the two gardens, we have two men who have vineyards, and one of them is grateful to God, and the other one is not. And there is a clear message about, you know, punishment and reward as a result of. And this, I mean, this follows just from what we were saying a moment ago about memory and forgiveness. These are not located anywhere in particular. And this followed by a parable of life in this world, which is again about monotheism, resurrection, reward, and punishment. There's a little digression about the story of Iblis, who is the equivalent of Satan. And there's a very interesting narrative where the angels are told to bow down to Adam, which would seem to be kind of an infringement of a divine sovereignty. But the only one who disobeys is Iblis. And so that's sort of the origins of rebellion and evil. That's in verse 50.
You know, right in the beginning there in, let me see, 32, 33,
mm-hmm.
34 is very reminiscent of part of the Song of Songs, about at the very end, where there's the part about, you know, Solomon had a garden and it produced, you know, so many fruit, but you, Solomon, keep your garden. You know.
That's right. I never thought of that.
It is kind of reminiscent of that.
But I think these serve to sort of highlight the notion of the resurrection. I mean, in that first parable, the doubtful person says, I don't think the hour is rising. So he can just turn his back and so forth, and then bad things happen to him. And it keeps emphasizing like in 54, the emphasis on, it refers to, I translate the term recitation, that's Quran. Actually, at this point, which is sort of a middle to later Meccan surah, when the word Quran occurs, it obviously didn't mean the complete book to the first audience. It just means a recitation of divine pronouncements without the sort of notion of closure of the canon. So how do the other people translate 54?
This is arbitrary.
Yeah. So it's sometimes hard to find the verses because they're not. He takes it a little bit out of the verse structure, which is
right.
A good thing for literature, but it's a little hard for reference.
1854.
But we have coined a parable or something like that. Oh, wait. The other problem with Arbery is, I forgot to tell you this. Up until about the 1960s, European scholars used a printed edition of the Quran that had been put together by a German scholar named Flügel, who used a slightly different numbering of verses than commonly is found in the Arabic text. So you need a chart to switch between the two numbering systems. It's another reason why, you know, Arbery provides it. Nowadays, we all use the Egyptian edition of 1925 as the verse forms. So,
what's it say?
Let's see.
Do you know what that verse says?
Yeah, four. It says, in this Quran we have presented every kind of illustration for people, but man is more contentious than any other creature.
What verse number is it in?
54.
54.
In this one.
Oh, in this one. Well, that's following the standard.
You found it, Chris?
Yeah, I found it here. I just don't know what verse it is. It's after 50, but it's way before 55.
It's more like 52 or 50.
Yeah, it's more like
52, 53.
Yeah.
Right. There he uses the term Quran, but I translated it as recitation because I wanted to get a different sense of the, you know, unfolding of the text before it was canonized.
Is Quran ever used, does it remain in Arabic as a word for recitation? Or does it now simply mean the fullness of the revealed Quran?
It is, you know, it has become a name rather than a generic term. But I think we can still see it as a generic term if we.
It could be something like Torah.
Right, The Torah is now the Torah. But
right.
When it's mentioned
teaching.
In the Bible,
instruction.
Yeah.
So, but let's push on to the other two stories, which are pretty interesting. I mean, the story that next follows is not a biblical story. It's about Moses and a figure that is generally referred to in Arabic tradition as Al-Khidr, which means literally the green one. And there's a prodigious amount of legend surrounding Al-Khidr, who is basically regarded as an immortal prophet who is still around. And according to popular lore, wherever he walks, green plants spring up in his footsteps. And there are many Sufi mystics who claim to have been initiated by a direct personal encounter with Khidr, including the famous Ibn Arabi of 13th century Spain, who, by the way, his book Sufis of Andalusia contains a lot of wonderful stories of personal encounters that cry out for cinematic treatment. So this is a kind of, but as I said, this has some things which are, which you could interpret as going all the way back to the Gilgamesh story. It starts off by saying, it never calls the young man, the unknown servant of God. There's three people in here. There's Moses, his servant, who's a young man, and then there's a servant of God who shows up, who's very mysterious. And so, it opens up. Moses said to the young man, "I won't stop till I reach the meeting of the oceans." or I'll go a long time. But when they reached the meeting between the two, they forgot about their fish, and it found its way to the ocean tunneling. Now, this is kind of enigmatic. But we find this also, it shows up in the Alexander Romance version. But if you go back to Gilgamesh, have you read the story of Gilgamesh?
Yes. It's a required reading, I think, for sophomore year.
Yes, yeah, okay. So you know about his quest for immortality. There's a plant of immortality and so forth. What happened is that, as we find out from the following verse, when they moved, they forgot about this place. When they got to it, they completely became amnesiac. But then later he says to the young man, bring our food. And then he says, did you see when we stopped at the rock, I forgot the fish? So what happened was they were at this mysterious place called the Meeting of the Two Oceans. And the servant had taken some water from this place to cook the fish, salted fish. And it came to life and swam away. And it was so fantastic a place that it made them forget about it until afterwards they realized their fish was gone, and then they went back and realized that this is the place they were going to. So this is a, you know, condensed version. And so that suggests that people are more familiar with the story and they don't need to have all the reminders. But Moses goes back to that place. He says, that's what we're looking for. They went back on their tracks and they found one of our servants whom we had offered our mercy, teaching him our knowledge. So this is where Chizur comes in. He's somebody who has received God's mercy and knowledge, and he knows more than Moses. And so we have these three incidents that take place that are very bizarre, where first of all, Moses says, please let me come with you. You know, I know that you're great. He says, you aren't going to be able to handle it. Moses says, no, I won't say anything. Says, okay, so this is the typical sort of story, the three offenses, the three chances he gets to shut his mouth. No, he can't. So the first one is they get on a ship, and in my translation, I just kept the word he with italics to mark who Chizur was here. As they rode upon a ship, he broke a hole in it. And Moses said, did you break it to destroy these people? You've done something stupid. But he said, didn't I tell you? You won't have patience to bear with me. So then Moses said, all right, I'll shut up. So basically, it seemed like Chizur committed a random act of violence by destroying the boat of these people. And Moses, you know, questioned that. But then they agreed to go on. So then they're walking down the road. They met a youth, and he killed him. Moses again objects. Have you killed a pure soul who hadn't killed another? You've done something horrible. And he said, didn't I tell you? You won't have patience to bear with me. And so then Moses said, all right, I will stop. So the third incident, they go to a village. They ask for food. The people are mean and send them away. So these are very bad people. And on the way out, they find a wall that's falling down, and Chizur fixes it. Now Moses is amazed because Chizur is repaying these nasty people with a good favor. And so Chizur says, this is the parting between us. I'll tell you the interpretation, the things you couldn't bear. First of all, the ship belonged to people who were fishermen, and he damaged it because otherwise it would have been seized by a tyrannical king. So he was actually helping them. The youth had two pious parents. We were afraid he'd assault them defiantly with unbelief, so we wanted the Lord to replace him with one of greater purity, one of greater kindness. So it was actually a blessing for the parents to remove this unfortunate young man. And the third one was that the wall, the falling down wall, was concealing a treasure belonging to some orphans, and if it had been exposed, then the bad people would have taken the money, and so this was to preserve that. So this was the secret, and so that's the interpretation that he couldn't bear. There's a lot of discussion about this particular story, but it also raises kind of interesting questions. But what do you think about the way that Chizur acts and Moses responds?
Well, it is interesting that Moses is in a position of responding, Moses is in the position of being instructed. So Moses, who's obviously one of the great prophets,
right.
This is apparently a person who is better than him in order to instruct him, which says something about the stature of who this person is, which presumably would mean he can't be wrong about what he's doing.
Well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? And even though you might say it's kind of, you know, it also raises some big questions about God's justice. You know, if God created a young man who was going to be evil, I mean, where does the responsibility lie? I mean, this is still pretty ambivalent or ambiguous. Any other thoughts about this story? Chris?
Well, yeah, I was just going to jump off what Kimberly said, but Professor Ernst, you kind of summed it up in a way. It's just the response. It's sort of Moses' response to each of these incidences in a very sort of natural or very human sort of way in terms of regarding just, I guess, standard conventions of morality. You know,
exactly.
You just don't go walk up to a boy and kill him.
Right.
And so it's a natural response to say, why did you kill him? And, you know, and again, you know, again, great prophet. Now he's, you know, in lieu of, you know, being put in this high position of being this prophetic sort of person, he's a person who's responding like every other person.
Mm-hmm.
And he's now in a position that's a little below Al-Khidr. Forgive me for mispronouncing that.
No, that's great. I mean, the Sufi mystical tradition, which is something I've written about quite a bit, regards Al-Khidr as somebody who has the inner knowledge, because the Quran says that he has knowledge from God. That's actually a very, very strong statement. Mm-hmm. And so Moses just knows the outer side of things, but Al-Khidr knows the inner side, and so that is a deeper aspect. So it kind of, in a way, you might say it sort of does some interesting strategic undermining of the obvious authority of the prophet of law and revelation, because Moses is mentioned more often than any other biblical prophet. I mean, there are hundreds of references to him in the Quran. But this is very unusual. One thing I also add, when we look a little bit outside of the text, some of you might know this famous work called The Motif Index of Folk Literature. It was produced by a folklorist named Arne Thompson, or a couple of folklorists, and it's, you know, basically a way of summarizing the gist of folk stories, so that you have these themes, and then, I mean, for instance, the Cinderella theme. There are countless versions of that around the world. This corresponds to what is known as tale type number 759, God's Justice Vindicated, also known as the Angel and the Hermit. So this is actually a well-known folk motif that's widely found throughout the world. So I think this is an interesting example of the Quran drawing on something like that as part of its scriptural section of a series of stories. And perhaps if we put this into conjunction with the rest of the context, if we assume that the theme of Surah 18 really is resurrection, then this notion of the internal versus the external sets up a very curious dynamic about, you know, the resurrection that is slightly in tension with the surrounding narratives. By the way, one other sort of formalistic point, if you count the letters and spaces in the Quran, well, actually, just the number of words in the Quran or something like that, Surah 18 is right in the middle, in the center of the text. And in ritual use, it is often selected for recitation on Fridays for particular benefits and so forth. People recite really fast because they know it by heart. But this particular story, being kind of in the center of the Quran, is sort of interesting from that point of view.
Well, and that's interesting theologically, because this actually does seem to be so important to the Muslim idea of theodicy, where in Christianity, no clear theodicy is ever given. Like, the Bible gives a bunch of different explanations for why God would act in a certain way at a certain time, but it's kind of the, you know, the explanation of evil is simply up for question, and the Bible never settles it. And this actually seems to give a more definitive explanation of anytime you see evil in the world, you can assume that God is actually up to something good. God is actually, you just don't have all the knowledge you need to understand what he's doing, which could actually lead to a more, I guess the negative side would be fatalistic, but just a more kind of black and white view of the world, or a more definite view of the world, that evil maybe isn't actually evil, or evil isn't actually what it seems, which is very different than the Christian idea. Does that make sense?
I think you're right that there's more, there's more of a rhetoric of explanation, mm-hmm. and commentary on the moral of the story in the Quran, and this does, set up that argument with more explicitness than the Bible does.
So yeah, I think that feels like that one part of the story feels like a greater good kind of theodicy, that mm-hmm. if you just knew this, then you realize this is really a good that's occurring. The boy's gone, so the parents won't suffer.
Yeah. I mean, it still might leave you with some questions, but...
Right.
I just wanted to say a couple more words about the last story. Now, this is, I call this the Alexander story. The term Alexander, which is actually known in Arabic, Iskandar is how it's written in Arabic. We have, Alexandria in Egypt is one of the cities founded by Alexander. But it doesn't mention his name as such, but it calls him Dhul Qarnayn, which means the one with the two horns. Now, why do we think this is Alexander? If you've got, I see, Judy, you have it turned open to 134. This coin from the Hellenistic period depicts Alexander with the horns of the ram. Mm-hmm. And this is because when he went to Egypt, he went to the shrine of Amon out in the desert oasis and was recognized as the incarnation of the god. And this became part of his imperial legend, that he was a divine figure. And so that's how we see him depicted on these coins. And so that's why I call him Alexander, even though some in some Muslim traditions they deny that, and they just say that this is a prophet who is not necessarily referred to by this Greek legend. This is a case where we need a little bit of help from some outside sources. There's a Syriac legend of Alexander, which has precise details that correspond very closely with this particular version, and which are not found, for instance, in the Greek legend of Alexander or some of the other versions. And let me just give you the background here. Alexander is seen here as the archetypal world ruler, to whom, as it said in verse 84, God has given power on earth. And he has a supernatural ability to travel from one end of the earth to the other by celestial pathways. This is kind of an obscure Quranic word, but I think this is what most people agree on it as being. It's found in verses 84, 85, 89, and 92. And it might remind you of the wormholes in science fiction movies, that take you from one place to the next. And so what happens is that Alexander first goes to the west, where he finds, in verse 86, a muddy spring, which in the Syriac version is a poisonous sea, which Alexander tests somewhat callously by sending in condemned prisoners. This is in the Syriac version. And when they die, then it's revealed that the sea is a deadly, impassable barrier that will require him to go back to his celestial pathways. The Quranic version doesn't, treat this as a kind of a heartless, use of human guinea pigs to, test the root, but actually talks about it as a generic administration of justice. So if you look at verse 86, it says, "We told him, Alexander, you can either punish them or treat them well. And he said, I will punish anyone who has committed crime." So if the Quran typically takes a sort of more moral portrait of the prophets. I mean, for instance, you know, David is treated not as having been committed sin and so forth, but much more of an exemplary person. And, that's the sort of the narrative thrust that we find here. Then, when Alexander goes to the east, he meets people who have to hide from the extreme heat of the sun, from which they have no protection. That's very brief and enigmatic in the Quran. The third, and this is really what connects us to the apocalyptic aspect, he reaches a mountain pass on the other side of which there are people with the barbarian characteristic of speaking an incomprehensible language. You know, the term barbarian was the Greeks used for foreigners who just couldn't speak Greek. You could only say bar, bar, bar. And so this is all about a very important aspect of the imaginaire of the ancient world. That is the enormous fear that people had of the Central Asian nomads, who were the bane of the urban civilizations for the last 2,000-3,000 years. And they were called Gog and Magog. And they were always seen whenever they came in, you know, Attila the Hun or Genghis Khan or whoever it might be, as a sign of the apocalypse. Because, I mean, there could be nothing worse than this. And so here the local people beg Alexander to protect them against the hordes of Gog and Magog. And he builds a wall of iron and brass to hold off the invaders. But then he concludes by talking about the collapse of the wall as an apocalyptic sign of judgment day. And so I've got a miniature painting there on page 135, which shows the iron wall. And Gog and Magog are portrayed as naked savages. In some cases, they're portrayed as demons, like some of those really jolly demons from the Persian, you know, tradition. So this is the story of Alexander, and that's, you know, I think one has to really push it together with this Syriac version to get, otherwise I think it's very hard to understand even, you know, the sequence of events here at all. But in the end, he makes the wall to keep the hordes of Gog and Magog out. But he says, this wall is a mercy from my Lord. When my Lord's promise comes, he will pulverize it. You know, this is the apocalyptic events. And so the trumpet will be blown. We'll draw up hell on display for unbelievers, etc. So the moralizing on the afterlife and judgment day is, you know, spun right into this. One other point I'd say, just from a historical point of view, is that I think that there's good evidence that this is an example of how the Quran shows signs of later insertions in the text. In other words, in the course of the prophetic career of Muhammad, there were passages that were added to, sometimes with long explanations inserted in the middle of short verses, to because of enigmatic passages that people were curious about. I think that the Alexander story was added later on because we can actually date it pretty precisely, because this legend of Alexander seems to have been, in the current version, seems to have been spread in the years 628, 629 by the Byzantines as part of their propaganda campaign in their war against the Persian Empire, because they wanted to have Byzantine Emperor Heraclius seen as fulfilling the prophecies of Alexander, that the kingdom of the Romans will annihilate the Persians. This is a part of the Syriac version that didn't get included in the Quranic account. But it strongly suggests to me that this was a Meccan surah which had three narratives in it. And then in the Medinan period, the Alexander story was added as a very appropriate sort of enhancement of the apocalyptic theme with some material that was very current that people were thinking about in light of the this titanic warfare between the two superpowers of the day that the Quran is very interested in. So that's a lot of unpacking that I thought, you know, might be helpful to reading this. But did you have any other thoughts about Alexander?
So is he considered a prophet?
As Dhul-Qarnayn, yes. And he was considered a prophet in the Christian Syriac version as well. Yeah.
You have, so do the unbelievers think that they can take my slaves as allies, not me. This translation says, did they think that they could take my servants as masters instead of me? And I've noticed, you know, in following this, is this, which translation is this?
It's Ali.
I mean, that's
Yusuf
a,
Ali.
That's a pretty big difference, allies and masters.
Yeah, this is a very tough word. The term, the root term is W-L-Y. And we, from this we get wali, which means friend or ally, and we get maula, which means client or master. And there's a lot of options in this. I mean, for instance, when people in the early Arab caliphate, when non-Arabs wanted to become Muslims, they were adopted as maula clients into Arab tribes. And the term maula could either mean the patron or the client. In other words, it's sort of like the same word is used for host and for guest.
So it's describing the relationship as
yeah.
much as the person.
So, you know, you could ask, so what, that was Yusuf Ali you're looking at, or?
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
Or is that, what's on your
this is the
iPad?
Which one is online?
Oh, that's Abdul Halim. Abdul Halim. That's a pretty good one. He's emphasizing the sort of, you know, political power. In other words, you can only take God as one's master. That's what he's saying.
Not a powerful king, but is that the contrast?
God
yes. is master, but not a powerful
yeah,
king.
Not any, or not any created entity,
even a powerful
yeah, one of two.
But the you could even say that the term, I mean, friend would probably be less justifiable here. But I chose allies because I'm sort of setting the bar even lower. You know, it's not so much a question of taking human beings as masters, but even taking them as, even relying upon them as allies. Is an infringement on divine sovereignty. So I set the bar a little bit lower in terms of, you know, how, what you can do to, you know, break the contract with God. But these are all issues that the translators, you know, have to sort of think about.
It seems evident enough, if, you know, the theme is resurrection. The first narrative, the sleeper's narrative, you have them waking up, which would be a typical way of talking about that. And then in this last, you have the day of judgment. So things are being brought to an end. And I can even see the garden parable. But what about the Moses narrative? What function does it have in that, in the resurrection theme?
Well, it's sort of a... It's a bit of a puzzler because there isn't any obvious emphasis on it, on the resurrection in this story. It's kind of a joker in the deck.
Unless it's something like, you know, the people are raised, the seven sleepers, then you have the garden parable, which is, you know, paradise. Either you're going to have paradise
or
you're going to be
Gehenna.
Kicked out of paradise. Then we'll be in the place where everything is made known. A place where, you know, here's a story of Moses actually understanding things that he didn't understand. And then kind of back to the earthy present day, we have a picture of judgment and of, you know, last days kind of playing out in front of us. So know that it's coming.
Well, the other thing is, you know, there is always a tension between the prediction of the last day and the uncertainty of its timing. And, you know, when St. Paul says we shall be transformed in the twinkling of an eye, you know, I mean, that's sort of foreshadowing when you get that that knowledge, but there's a barrier there. And so the Moses story is talking about the fact that we cannot know that inner story about when this is going to happen. Maybe that's where the connection really lies.
Kind of the uncertainty, but you can be certain. There is.
Yes.
There is somebody who knows, and there's somebody who knows what he's doing. But it's not you, and you're left to ask questions in the meantime, but you can be certain about it.
Right. Yeah.
It could be the kind of, you know, in the Gospels, you get that kind of look and listen with respect to what's coming in. You watch for it, and in the meantime, you listen to these words and obey them. I guess it could be similar to that.
But it's interesting that, you know, people take these narratives and they kind of historicize them and localize them. There are about seven locations. Not only do we have a lot of shrines to the seven sleepers throughout Asia, as well as in Europe, but there are different, at least seven locations that have been proposed for the Gates of Alexander, including the Caspian Gates, and there's sites in Central Asia. So forth. So people, you know, take these narratives and localize them a lot. And of course, the same thing is done in terms of pilgrimage tourism. And we know this because we have books written in Arabic in the 11th century about all the different shrines. And, you know, there's quite a few biblical prophets and other individuals who have several tombs, and the narrators will usually use the Arabic formula, "Wallahu a'lam," God knows best which of these is true. Anyway, I think you can see how this is a pretty interesting little collection of stories that sits in a fairly central place in the Quran. And while it has some pretty strong moralizing messages, it also does retain an air of mystery that also, you know, problematizes, you know, the ability of people to know some of those key doctrines, like, you know, when the resurrection is going to take place. So there's a pretty strong presentation.
Is that idea of the mystery or secret, you consider that prominent in the Quran?
Yes, the notion, I mean, there's a term which is translated often as the hidden, which could mean, you know, visually, you know, inaccessible, but could also mean the future events that are not known. And only God knows the hidden, for the most part. So that notion that this Al-Khidr has been granted special knowledge does, you know, single him out, and that's one of the reasons he becomes so prominent in the mystical tradition.
And we read, yeah, go ahead.
Just a curiosity, in terms of Islam in the modern world today, just people who practice Islam, are they generally educated about just like the stories of these characters, like Dhul-Qurnayn?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm just curious if maybe across the world there's a Muslim who was just as confused by Dhul-Qurnayn as I am, or I was when I read this. It's like, who in the world is this? Is there that sort of educational system that says,
yeah,
well, some people say this or that, or so on and so forth?
Well, just a couple of points. First of all, over 80% of Muslims don't know Arabic. They don't understand Arabic. And so they are supposed to, you know, memorize parts of the Quran for the prayers because translations don't count in that context. But as far as literacy and understanding the text, you know, that's, you know, a matter of educational background, and obviously there are people who are well educated and there's a lot of people who are not. That being said, there is also an enormous narrative tradition that expands upon the Quran, and, you know, as I mentioned, there was a great deal of interest in this Israeliyat traditions, and so people would want to know a lot of details that are not specified in the Quran, and this was sometimes filled in from all these early Jewish and other narrative traditions. So there's a large commentary literature on the Quran where, for instance, if you were curious to know the name of the dog of the seven sleepers, it was Qitmir. So now you know. And
that's great. The field.
It has.
Whether that was how they got that, I'm not sure. But there were also collections of tales of the prophets, which were extremely popular. And we've got records of, it used to be a huge professional business for people to be storytellers. And we have accounts from medieval Baghdad of two storytellers working opposite ends of an alley, you know, and taking people up to the cliffhanger end and saying, well, I just can't quite remember the next part of the story until somebody chips in a few coins. And these guys were also sort of notorious for, shall we say, embellishing their stories a little bit to fit the demands of the crowd. And so there's a whole treatise on storytellers that talks about them and, you know, when they went too far and all this kind of thing. And so then there's these books of tales of the prophets that circulated initially in Arabic and then in other languages like Persian and Turkish, and then a huge amount of oral storytelling that was going on. So I think there would be, you know, a lot of people who couldn't read the Quran and tell you what it meant. I mean, they might be able to recite it, but would have some version of these stories that they had been told.
Even now, today?
Yeah. I think that there's still a kind of, I mean, of course, there are people who have been totally educated in a Western system who may be somewhat removed from those traditions. But I think that there's a lot of people in Arab countries, in Iran, Turkey, and South Asia, Southeast Asia, who have been told stories of these people. And, you know, because, you know, these names, by the way, are perpetuated in, you know, for instance, the term, you know, the name Aaron in Arabic is Harun. There's a lot of people named Harun. There's a lot of people named after their different prophets. And so those stories are kept alive. And that's still a prominent element. I mean, it's, you know, popular culture is kind of eroding a lot of those traditional things. People are listening to modern Arabic hip-hop and, you know, similar forms of current production. But there's still, these things still have some staying power.
I have a question. Now, in looking a little bit at this translation and looking at your translation, yours is much more condensed. What is the style of the original Arabic? I mean, this person clearly is sort of adding words to fill out the understanding of the reader.
Are you seeing parentheses too?
No, there's not. No. Just the way he translates
mm-hmm.
it. It's very almost like telling a story.
Kind of like the living Quran.
Yeah. Now, but what I'm asking is, the original Arabic, is that more?
It's more concise.
Verses?
It is more concise.
So that's what you
tried
to.
I try to do it. I, you know, rarely will use a little device like the parentheses or an italics or. I wanted people to have a sense of the terseness of style rather than sort of converting it into an informational
mm-hmm.
commentary. So those are always choices you make. And actually, I do some of them in different styles, some of them more contemporary and direct, and I unpacked this, you know, by length of sort of, you know, of a breath, instead of keeping it as a single run-on paragraph. And I think that makes it a little more readable. But that doesn't happen in the sort of complete translations. That's all, you know, solid text, pretty much. Or they might have some paragraphs just to break them
up. So for an Arabic speaker to hear the Quran recited, it would be more, in your judgment, like the way you've translated it, rather than these kind of story.
But I think we by the way, we've got to let these students go because they probably have something else. We've run out of time, but I've got a little app on my phone here. I think I might be able to play you this particular text. If you want to hear how it sounds, but sometimes, you know, as a translator, you need to forget the original text after you've translated it, because your reader is not going to be able to refer back to the original. And so it's, you've got to make it stand on its own. But I do think that many translators try to achieve some echo of the style of the original in the target language. And that's what I attempted to do. One of the other strategies they use is to sort of copy the King James style, which I think is probably a bad move.
I think Falkaya does that a little bit.
I think with the assumption that conveys a certain majesty and authority, but you know, what worked in the 17th century is not necessarily for today's audience. That's the problem. So I'm just downloading this. It'll be up in a second. But there is, you know, something about the Quranic style that's quite remarkable. And so I'll just set this up in a second. You can actually hear a lot of cadence and rhyme in this. Just about there.
Who's the reciter?
This one is someone named Saud Ashuraim. You have his recording.
No, I have Mishir.
ولم يجعل له عوجا قيما لينذر بأسا شديدا من لدنه ويبشر المؤمنين الذين يعملون الصالحات أن لهم أجرا حسنا ماكثين فيه أبدا وينذر الذين قالوا اتخذ الله ولدا ما لهم به من علم ولا لآبائهم كبرت كلمة تخرج من أفواههم إن يقولون إلا كذبا فلعلك باخع نفسك على آثارهم إن لم يؤمنوا بهذا الحديث أسفا إنا جعلنا ما على الأرض زينة لها لنبلغهم أيهم أحسن عملا وإن
That was the first 8 verses.
Beautiful.
Everyone got that?
Yeah. I think I'd sing it back now.
And very rhythmic,
it really is.
As well.
Yeah, yeah.
Very
you can imagine percussion.
Yeah,
everything.
It has quantity. Long and short, it's quite explicit that you would also find in a language like Latin or Greek. But instead of a stress rhyme, it has long and short.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So we'll pick up reading more next week, right?
Next week.
Okay.
All right. Sounds good.
Very good. Now that we know how to do it.